QC, Ed and Darren love feeling fresh in the morning. But for those morning pick-me-ups, they grab a regular cup of freshly ground coffee for just $2. Available 24/7 at 7-Eleven.
Good morning. And get up. Now count me in.
QC, Ed and Darren. QC, Ed and Darren.
Count around your radio now for QC, Ed and Darren.
Dramatic weekend in Sydney. Aaron, you live very close to the Bondi Junction shopping centre.
Yeah, just a couple of minutes away. And I think, you know, one thing that I'm seeing a lot of and feeling myself as well is just so many mums go to shopping centres when they're first time mums or new mums or 10 times mums, because it's, you know, a place where you can wind down the clock, wait for your hubby or whoever to get home. You don't want to be at home alone. And it's so relatable. It's easy. You go get a coffee, look at the shops, kid has a play. And yeah, it's just, it hits close to home, I think, for everyone.
So many people were there Saturday afternoon, including a friend of ours and a friend of the show. And she joins us now. Lisa Greenberg, welcome to the show.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, Lisa. I saw on your socials that you were there when it happened. What did happen and what was your involvement?
Yeah, I was caught up in the madness. I was there for the happy occasion of having my makeup done for a party that evening. And I was sitting in the makeup chair. The makeup artist and I were commenting on how busy the centre was, school holidays full of really happy, giggling young girls. And the general vibe was so positive and excited. And then we heard screaming and the store went silent from giggling to silent.
So you're sitting there and you literally hear screaming while you're sitting in the chair.
And it was different to, you know, girls squealing, like that fun school holiday sort of squealing. And we all went quiet and then sort of said, oh, that doesn't sound normal, but you don't want to assume the worst. So we just kept chatting. And then a few seconds later, we heard several gunshots and we were told to very quickly go into lockdown. And I didn't have a clue what that meant. None of us did. And then we saw the front door, which was a clear door, not a garage door, but very quickly being slammed, which I'd never seen before. And we were very quickly ushered to a back staff room. We heard blood-curdling screams and we were pushed into a staff room that was fairly small. The door was shut and we all just stared at each other in silence. And there was deafening sirens just over and over, and we realized we were in some danger. It's that unknown.
It could have been you have an assumption. Is this a terror attack? Are there multiple people out there causing mayhem?
We had no idea. We fortunately had a camera that I guess the staff must use for shoplifting or whatever, and it was pointed out to the front of the store. And we looked through the door that had been slammed out into the centre, and it had gone from just fun girls out there. The whole centre was eerily quiet. I've never seen Westfield quiet. There was not a soul we could see on the cameras. And I just kept saying to people, it's okay, we can see. There's no one there. We're safe in here. We got boxes of makeup. We barricaded ourselves in. And
was there a lock on the door that you were behind?
I don't remember. I just know that we got boxes and sort of barricaded ourselves in. Just, oh, I guess, Jesus. By doing, we felt we were doing something.
How many of you were in that room?
It was maybe 30, and there was varying ages. I remember there was a little girl in front of me who had a dinosaur jumper on, and I kept saying to her, look at your beautiful sparkly dinosaur. They're going to keep us safe. They're going to keep us safe.
Well, which store were you in, Lisa, if you don't mind saying? Like, was it a department?
I was in Mecca.
Mecca. Because I think there was another makeup store where someone did lose their life.
No, we had heard the gunshots. I asked if there was water bottles, because then people started, once we realised we were in there and the sirens were blaring, then people started to hyperventilate. But it's quite bizarre, right? Because when one would lose it, everyone would rally around and we're okay, we're going to be okay. We all picked up our phones. We tried to call. I just wanted to speak to my family and know I was safe. And I went through my favorites.
Oh, of course.
And Todd was on the bloody golf course, so he didn't pick up, of course.
And just for people listening, actually, it's Lisa Greenberg. Todd, your husband, was the boss of the NRL, and so he has a very public profile.
So how long before you were able to tell your loved ones that you were safe?
You know, it's all a blur. I went to my second one, Erin, you know, my gorgeous girl, Lara, who's 36 weeks pregnant. Yes. I got onto her. She said all she could hear was massive sirens. And as soon as I heard her voice, I was trying to be so calm and so together, and I lost it. And I just said to her, I love you so much, Lara, and I just wanted her to know that I loved her. And we spoke really briefly. She told me she loved me, and then we got disconnected. And then we just all stood there and
how long were you in there?
Just rallied.
How long were you in there? An hour before. Was an hour before you realised you were going to be safe, or was it?
We didn't know we were going to be safe. We just.
Yeah.
Then this voice came over the speakers and said, "Now run."
Oh.
And I said to everyone, "What do you mean? What if that's the shooter who's now got control and we're running?" Yeah. I said, "I think we should stay here.
Yeah.
I think we need to stay here. We're safe. We can see out. I think we need to stay." And then the voice came over, "Get out of the stores and we need to run." And we just had a phone. They opened the door. We moved all the barricading and we just ran and we were told to run fast. We didn't know where we were going and who we'd see, what was ahead of us. We were herded out. I saw a policeman who pushed me out towards Oxford Street and I just ran and I hoped I was going in the right direction. And I finally picked up the phone and I ran Todd and I said, "I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do." And he said, "Run towards Queen's Park." And I've never seen so many helicopters, policemen, SWAT teams. It's coming back to me in little bits now. I remember thinking people were wearing red shirts, but it was obviously blood. And I just ran. And it's so funny. As we ran past, people were squeezing each other's hands, putting hands on shoulders, just reassuring each other that we were okay. And I just sprinted down. I found Toddy. I got in the car and I lost it. And
what was his reaction, Lisa?
He was calm and just reassuring me, "Take a few deep breaths. You're okay." By this stage, there had been some information on the media and he said, "There was a guy with a knife. He's been shot. You're okay. You're okay. We're going to get home." He said, "Your face looks beautiful. Your hair looks lovely."
Oh, bless.
Very smart man. Very smart man, Debbie.
And how are the kids now? They're obviously quite emotional about it, I'd assume.
They are. You know, I have images of me walking, like you or you two, you know, walking around with my soon-to-be grandson through the what I thought was the safety of a beautiful Westfield. But, you know, I believe connection is innate. And I refuse to allow one madman to just decrease that, because we, with the benefit of hindsight, me looking back to that little room, we connected in a way that wasn't agenderized. We all just connected, trying to keep each other positive, trying to keep each other safe. And that's what I'm choosing to focus on, not the actions of one madman.
Good.
You know, I may not ever forget those gunshots and those blood-curdling screams, but I'm not going to focus on that. I'm giving my attention to that connection, because the kindness of strangers was amazing. You know, that's something that no one told us to do, but we all just did it. And that's my power. I think that is my superpower. We've all got this superpower of choice, and that's what I'm choosing to focus on.
Yeah, that's amazing, Lise. Thank you for sharing.
Today FM. Just spoke to Lisa Greenberg, who was in Bondi Junction, and she ended up in a room with 30 other people at Mecca, barricading the door. They didn't know whether it was a terrorist attack or not.
Yeah, the bit that kind of hit me that she said was the announcement over the speaker in the shopping centre telling people to get out and run, and their thought that that could be, you know, the gunman who they didn't know what was going on.
How
someone
many
had
were
a
there?
Gun
of course,
and, yeah,
any idea.
Horrific.
But she did talk about hearing gunshots, and the person who actually fired that gun was a real hero. She's a police woman, police inspector Amy Scott, who'd been a police person for 19 years, and So it was just, she just ran towards danger, didn't she?
She was incredible. Looking at vision of her on the morning shows at the moment, just how quickly she ran towards obvious danger, not knowing whether someone had a bomb, someone had guns. You know, she had no idea, but she just sprinted towards. And the incredible people behind as well, who ran with chairs and whatever else. But it was just the way, you know, you talk about football and training and how you can't emulate a match or match fitness. And this is the thing with cops. They're training to do something that they hope they never have to do.
Yeah.
But training is so different to the real thing. And that's when you've got to rely on so much work and your instinct. And she, you know, did everything right. Told him to put it down. He didn't. She shot him. Then she tried to resuscitate. Then, she, you know, she just did everything by the book so perfectly and so bravely. It's incredible.
And she just did it on her own. Yeah, she didn't.
Yep.
There was no, she didn't call
no
her.
No backup, no.
I'm just going to do it because I'm here and I'm going to go in.
Yeah, just, apparently she was treating someone first and obviously didn't realise that there was still an existing threat or something,
right.
And then realised and people, yeah, then she ran.
But again, she's not to know if there's not multiple
no,
people
exactly.
there. No one's to know what this is. Is it a major terrorist attack? So anyone who ran towards the danger, incredible.
Yeah.
But her in particular, what a wonderful job she did.
We talk a lot about police, don't we, and how they run towards what we all run away from. And it's just, I think, another little reminder, you know, when you get annoyed if one of them, you know, pull you over you know, people are dismissive of them in the street, or just how grateful we should be for what they're willing to do every day.
This is the Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
The Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
Obviously, everyone is still reeling from what happened at Bondi Junction over the weekend. Multiple people killed by a crazed gunman, knifeman, and of course, people still in hospital. Kelly Sloan, who is a member for Vaucluse. I know, Kelly, you were actually out at Cook handing out, I think, flyers for the by-election there when you heard what was happening and you rushed straight to the scene. Is that right?
Yeah, Erin, that's right. It was, it seemed so out of the blue. I got a phone call from my son saying, "Hey, Mum, just letting you know that I'm safe." And I'm like, "What?" You know, picked up the phone and he'd been at Bondi Junction. He wasn't caught up in it. He was fine. His friends were in there. But I just jumped in the car and headed straight back, of course. And by the time I got back into the eastern suburbs, you know, it had been unfolding that it was the most horrific attack. And the details have been horrifying. So, yeah, it's just been horrible.
Where was your son when it happened? Was he nearby the centre? Oh.
Yeah, he was right where it had all happened and had literally walked away a few minutes earlier. So, you know, when he checked his phone and his statement, you could see he'd bought a smoothie at exactly the same time.
How old's he?
So he's 16.
Yeah,
look,
right.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about, I mean, obviously he and his friends are processing this, and because of modern day media, the kids are sharing images, stuff that's really quite awful that hasn't, you know, that we're not publishing.
Yeah,
but,
right.
And so we really need to look after our kids right now.
I did not know that was online. So there's images of that they're not being.
I opened Instagram and immediately, Kelly, there was an Instagram account I follow and they had very graphic footage almost immediately. That was.
And the kids, kids share it on chats that we don't see.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
On Snapchat and the disappearing messages. So they're all seeing some pretty awful content. So, you know, we're providing support services for kids at the moment as well. And for parents, and I met with the education department yesterday. They've sent out information to schools, to government and public and to the independent schools, just to give parents a heads up and the resources they need to have those conversations.
Kelly, you've spoken a fair bit recently since October last year regarding a lot of people in your community are Jewish. They're doing it incredibly tough. There's been a huge rise in anti-Semitism. Now this, it's just your community is going through a really rough patch at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, I've been the local member only a year, and in the space of that time, two really impacting incidents here, and not to compare one to the other, but to give you a sense that, you know, 20% of the eastern suburbs is Jewish. And they are feeling very vulnerable right now. So as this happened on the weekend, there was also, you know, Iranian airstrikes on Israel. It's a community that's been dealing with rise in anti-Semitism. And I know the Islamic community is also facing a rise in anti-Islamophobia as well. So, you know, but that gives you a sense of the vulnerability. So people are already scared. They're already feeling worried about going into public spaces. Yeah. And of course, when this happened on the weekend, there was like, oh God, I hope this isn't terrorism.
Yeah, yeah, we all.
I'm part of a lot of group chats with a lot of parents at my daughter's school are Jewish, and they were, yeah, thinking that exact same thing.
And thank goodness it wasn't, but everyone is still feeling vulnerable, and the broader community is, everyone's shaken up. No one can comprehend how this act of horror against a baby, for goodness sake, against women, targeting women, and that's what all my friends, all the chat groups I'm on are talking about, you know, that this was violence against women. And more broadly speaking, that's an issue we need to have a chat about, you know, at the right time. But people are scared. They're going, this was our safe space. You know what it's like, Erin, that you probably spend several days a week there, like, you know, every mum in the eastern suburbs, and our kids go there and hang out. It's where we do our shopping. It's where we get our haircuts. It's you know, every Westfield is kind of the hub of your community. Yeah. And to have that trust broken by a crazy person that is, you know, out of the blue, people are still trying to make sense of it.
We're all hailing Police Inspector Amy Scott for the actions that she took to run towards danger and neutralise the situation in the most professional manner available and possible.
She is our hero. You know, if she hadn't stepped in with such professionalism, knowing her job, focused and determined and running towards danger, you know, there is no doubt more lives would have been lost. So our community is so grateful to her. We're so grateful to everyone that stepped in, from the Bondi lifesaver who was doing the resuscitation to Bollard guy, to people that were running at this guy with chairs. I mean, it sends chills as I'm talking about it now still. But there were so many brave people who were trying to stop this man who was cowardly going after the most vulnerable.
The Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
Erin, you live right there, basically.
Yeah, just a couple of minutes away. It's my local shopping centre, and it is for a lot of people in the eastern suburbs. And to be honest, it's also a kind of special occasion for most people in Sydney. It's, you know, it's Bondi Westfield. It's kind of the big one. So, it's the kind of place where mums take their kids in prams to, you know, pass 3 hours because it's a long day when you're at home with a baby. And, you meet your friends for coffee, you window shop, you go to Kmart.
Yeah, of course.
It's, it's awful.
You have another connection with Singo, your friend.
Yeah, so John Singleton, a friend of mine, I actually had him on my Sky show last week and spoke to him about, lots of different things, life, his feelings on, you know, retirement, getting older, what he was planning on doing
next,
et cetera. He's so funny. He's great. I asked him at the end if he had any confessions and he said, I wouldn't have time. You know, he's just a renowned larrikin. And at the end, you know, I asked him, I said, because he's just been divorced for the 7th time. And I kind of said, you know, asked him about the fact that he, you know, in terms of his life, does he feel like he's missing something that he needs to solidify a connection? And he kind of answered like this.
Do you just not want to date? Like, do you feel this need to commit? Like,
well, it was 20 years between the 6th and the 7th. So
actually, that's a fair stint.
I thought I'd retire. But then, happy on my own. I've got a very good dog.
Yeah.
Got great friends, great family, great kids, great grandkids.
Are you happy?
Yeah, very.
So that was literally a week and a half ago. Great kids, great grandkids. Are you happy? Yes. You know, and it just, for those, I'm sure most people are aware, but his daughter was caught up in that attack and lost her life. His 25-year-old little girl called Dawn, who was due to get married.
Beautiful
girl. Beautiful girl. She, and he spoke about her a few years ago because he had a racehorse called Little Dawny, and he said that most people thought he'd named it after Dawn Fraser, but it was after his girl, who he had actually named after Dawn Fraser.
Yeah.
So it just, how life can change.
And she was about to get married, is that right?
She was about to get married to a New South Wales policeman who was actually called to Bondi as part of this. And when he got there, realised that his fiancée was one of the victims. But, you know, it just breaks your heart. You kind of, I spent a day last week with Singo. You know, he came and picked me up and we went and looked at a new horse that he'd bought. We had a bite to eat at his restaurant, and literally a couple of days later, his whole world has fallen apart, and it just breaks your heart.
How can he bounce back? That man who's always got a smile on his face, who's always laughing.
Even people I know have lost children through different ways. A girlfriend who passed away overseas, and her parents, I think it's been 11, 12 years, they are still shadows of them, their former selves. I don't think you ever recover. It's it's horrific.
Today FM. We've already spoken to a number of people, including Lisa Greenberg. She was there.
She was in Mecca, the makeup store, getting her makeup done for a party that night, and she had to go into lockdown, which was terrifying.
She was with 30 other people barricaded inside the makeup
staff room at the back. Yeah, we've spoken to Kelly Sloan, the local member who rushed over there. Her son had messaged her, telling her what was going on, and now we've got a really special guest.
We do a man who was inside a Bondi. Junction at Westfield. You know him from Bondi Rescue, lifesaver Reedy. Andy Reed, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, team. How are we this morning?
Hey. Mate, we're all trying to deal with what happened on Saturday, but you were there, mate. Can you take us through it from your vantage point?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I was just buying a bunk bed for the kids in Maya, and I was talking to one of the sales assistants, and another sales assistant came up to us and said, we needed to evacuate. There's been someone stabbing people outside, and I was just like, wow, that's pretty intense. And then we went to go leave, and the shutters had come down.
Yeah.
So they'd obviously, to keep us all safe, they pulled the shutters down, and just as we went to look through the holes in the shutters, I heard the three gunshots go off.
Yeah.
I think it was two or three, and I thought, oh, maybe it's not someone being stabbed. Maybe there's like a shooter in the building, you know. And You start to think worst case scenario, because you start thinking of stuff that happens in America, and then you actually, and the sounds of the gunshots echoed so loud in Westfield. And I think it actually happened on our level five. And as I panned back across, looked at the escalators, because I saw a few people running around, I just saw a woman laying outside. I think it was Cotton On. And she had a lot of really bad injuries. And I could just tell. And there was only sort of, at the time, there was only sort of one person working on her on their own, and I was like, I started thinking about my first aid training and thought, I've just got to get down there and help her. And I couldn't get out the shutter on level five, so I went into the internal escalators in Meyer and ran down the escalators and asked the security guard if he could open the shutter for me, and I just went under the shutter and just went around the back of the escalator, and then I saw her, and then I looked down through the shops, and what I saw next, I kind of wish I hadn't seen it. It was horrible. It was just like there was multiple patients. It was just like a trail of destruction. And so I grabbed some clothes off the shelves at Cotton On. Someone had already put jeans on her back shoulder wound. But yeah. I don't think it wasn't clotting the blood enough. So we got some cotton clothes and we were putting it in the wound and just made sure we sort of stabilized her. And then I looked up and there was another patient sort of being helped by a couple of police officers, but at the time they needed to be looking for what we thought was the second attacker.
Yeah.
And so I went over and relieved them and started doing some CPR on the next patient and sort of did my best with her and the police went to sort of, and then a couple of paramedics arrived on scene and they were sort of helping me and helping the other woman. And then I left, we did some more CPR on her and then I left her with the paramedics and went to another one that was further up. And that's where I sadly walked past and it's probably the image that I'll never forget is the lone pram sitting there, you know, I've got three young kids and I just thought, why is this pram sitting there? Like where's the baby? Where's the mum? And then I looked back at the lady that I'd just been working on. I thought, I wonder if that was her child. And if it is, you know, obviously a lot of things are going through my head at the time, and then I thought I'll just go and help with the next patient, and sadly I don't think the ambulance had arrived with her and they called it on her, sadly. And I looked around and I saw there were so many police by then and so many paramedics, and I just thought I'll let the professionals do their job, and I got out of there. So but yeah, sadly that was when I found out, once I was outside and went to go wash off, that's when I found out that my friend was one of the ones potentially in there, and she was in hospital fighting for her life.
Scene, like obviously nothing you'd ever seen before in your life, but they were quite close together at the victims.
They were probably the two near the escalators that I mainly worked on. They were probably about 30 meters apart. But and then the next one was probably about 50 metres up, maybe 100. And then there was even another one that I didn't even go up to because they were getting worked on by police and ambulance. So I got out of there. There were so many police, they were doing such a good job. I just did what I could do, what I needed to do, and where I thought I could help, and got out of there.
It's kind of, you know, one of the things that I can't stop trying to figure out, and I don't know how to figure it out, is how he was able to inflict so much damage on so many people, like to be able to kill with a knife. Like, you can cut with a knife, but to be able to kill, like what were the nature of those injuries on those people?
Oh, Aaron, I've gone into detail in a couple of other interviews, and I sort of feel sick thinking about it now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know there's kids listening and stuff, and I just, you know, it's, I don't ever want anyone to have to see what we saw. Like, it was a big weapon. Like,
yeah,
you know, he did some damage, and yeah. One thing I can't stop thinking about is my poor friend Ash, who had to hand her baby to strangers.
Like, oh, she's so brave.
You know what,
mate?
I mean?
So brave.
What a heroic act from
her. Final act.
Know, like,
oh, it's incredible.
You know, but from your point of view, you would have thought there was more than one attacker because of how many victims. So it would have been, I mean, you wouldn't have been thinking about it at the time, I imagine, but you would have thought there's probably more people just all over the place.
Oh, mate, to be honest, I was just sort of tunnel vision on what we had to do to help the patients that we had near us. I was a little bit worried for a while that potentially, because I was looking at the wounds and I was thinking, are these, like, because we still didn't know that the attacker had a knife. I still thought maybe it's gunshots and maybe you just didn't know. Like, and there's still police running around, and it was like, well, maybe are we at risk here? And you just kind of like, but then you just focus on just making sure we could stop the bleeding and stuff, and just do the best we could. Yeah. But I mean, hats off to the guys that confronted the guy, the Bollard guys, like those guys.
Yeah,
they're the heroes. The female police officer,
Amy Scott. We need to say her name.
Like,
yeah, please inspect Amy Scott.
Of the year, like, she
was
like,
incredible. Yeah. Reddy, will you get some help afterwards? I know that you're used to kind of, you know, drama in some ways, but, you know, will you talk to someone, or because that's a big part of, you know, first responders and what they go through?
100%. Like, you have to do that. If you don't, you know, you're silly. You've got to go and talk to people about it. You've got to, you know, I already see a counsellor regularly, you know, for the things that you know, just regular day-to-day life. It's just good to talk to people, especially professionals that know how to help you open up. So
good on you.
Without a doubt. Yeah, I'll probably see two this week.
Like, fair enough.
A burden shared is a burden, you know.
Great advice, Reedy, and brilliant.
This is the Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
The Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
And joining us now is today's show psychologist, Sandy Wraith. Nice to thank you for coming this morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Sandy, it's a confronting time for everyone in Sydney. The events are well known now on Saturday afternoon. We've spoken to two people who were there at the centre already, and I mean, obviously they're going to have special situations to deal with over the coming months or years. But
yeah, what about those who even weren't there, Sandy, but people who have just seen what's going on, or people whose kids have seen and have questions? That's what we really wanted to chat to you about today, is how do we broach the subject with our kids?
It's a really good point about this, about, you know, people who aren't there. So there is this thing called vicarious PTSD. So what that means is that, you know, I guess most of us are aware of what, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder is, when we're, you know, witness to an act of violence, been involved in a sexual abuse or, you know, some other awful life event. But we know that people experience, you know, quite significant distress from that. You know, it might be bedwetting, it might be hallucinations, it might be nightmares, etc. It's a whole raft and a whole range of somatic and physical disorders as a result. But we also now know through research that people can get post-traumatic stress vicariously, especially, we're talking mainly about young people under 10 years of age. So that means by watching and immersing and discussing and talking and watching every media release and the news consistently, they actually take on the very same symptoms as those people who've been witness or been involved in a particular, you know, act of violence. So we have to be really mindful about this. Whilst the news is saturated with it, and rightly so, our duty of care, I guess, to our young people is to really monitor very carefully what they're exposed to. Because, you know, they will, in school refusal, bedwetting, nail biting, regressive behaviour, they're the sorts of things that we know that young people may experience if we don't guard and monitor what they're watching.
I've got two daughters, one's 13, one's 11. One of their friends was over yesterday and the news came on at 5 o'clock and they all were like transfixed by the story. Do you think kids that age, you should try to, you know, shield them from it if they're over like 11, 12, 13 or?
No, Dane, I don't think that at all. I don't think we should be shielding them in totality, but we need to be careful and mindful of the language we use at particular ages. The language naturally we use for a 5-year-old is going to be very different for a 10, 11 or 12 or 13-year-old. But it's about the level of saturation. So, you know, first of all, are you able, not you personally, but, you know, is the parent, is the adult in charge able to have these conversations? So, for instance, parents who were actually involved in the saga, they may not be emotionally or physically able to have those discussions with their children as a family. You know, parents who weren't involved but the children are watching, as you just rightly said, do you feel comfortable talking about trauma and the impact this may have on their lives? So absolutely have the discussion, understand the level of their emotional maturity is, and then decide to cut it off. So we don't want to see a recycled news at 6, then at 6:30, then at 7:30, et cetera, et cetera. So by all means, to have the discussion, what are their interests? What do they want to talk about? What do they think might happen to the people who've suffered? That's fine discussions to have, but we don't need to have it saturated and on repeat, repeat, repeat.
Sandy, what about young kids? As you know, my daughter's nearly 6, so 5, she's in kindy, and I'm in a kind of group chat with other mums at the school who live a couple of minutes away from Bondi, and one of the mums had said, you know, last year with the October 7, she obviously didn't discuss it with her child. She's Jewish, but at daycare, the kids were talking about it, and she kind of sent me a message a couple of days ago saying, we've got 2 weeks to tell our little loves, that's how she phrased it, you know, what happened in the most, you know, kind of, you know, responsible and comforting way before they get to school where, of course, we're, you know, 2 minutes away from where it happened, where it will be spoken about. Like, so, because I wouldn't have even thought to tell my daughter. I wouldn't have even thought
No.
So, like, what do you do when they're that age, but you know that at school it's going to be talked about?
And sometimes the real different values in family, and there's all that conflict. And that's going to happen throughout her school life. There'll be lots of things that happen. And I think one of the most important messages, so, you know, you can say something happened and someone who was, you know, perhaps who wasn't very well. You know, you can use different language. You know, you don't have to talk about extreme acts of violence and the trauma. But overall, the message that you would teach a young child is things happen, but you are safe. And it's going to happen throughout your life. When we get in the car, it's always a risk when we get in the car that we might have an accident. But mummy's a good driver and it's not likely to happen.
Yeah.
So it's about possibility.
So acknowledging it, but reassuring.
Acknowledging it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think the two key words here are possibility and probability. And they're really important words in our language in life. You know, is it possible? Yes, it's possible. But is it probable? No. And then I think the other message is really talking about how many good people there are in the world.
Yeah.
You know, look at how many first responders. Look how many citizens came to help each other. Look at the love and support around it. Unfortunately, there was one person who was not very well, who really did some awful things. And that's what happens in life. But our job is to look after people who are well, and our job is also to look after people who aren't well. So those sorts of conversations are the ones that are very empowering. And, you know, to that point, it's very important to have teachable moments. And perhaps a positive narrative out of this is a teachable moment about how we share and look after each other.
Yeah, lovely.
Well, Sandy Ray, Today Show Psychologist, thank you so much for your time this morning. And again, Lifeline 13 11 14 if anyone feels like they need help.
The Husey, Ed and Erin Podcast.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has impacted me the most and a lot of other women I know is just let's add to the list of other places in the world that we're not safe. You know, as a woman, you go into a car park, you don't feel safe. You might call someone, so you've got someone on the phone just in case something happens. You want to go for a run in the morning, well, you can't do that because you'll be killed. You want to go for a run at night, well, you can't do that, it's too dark. You want to wear a skirt out to a bar with your girlfriends, you can't do that because that might attract the wrong type of attention. You can't drive anywhere in your car because women get murdered in their cars. At home, we get murdered at home. more than anything else, we get murdered at home. And now add that to a Westfield shopping centre is another place that women don't feel safe. And this whole mental health thing, sorry, we all have mental health. I get anxious, I don't kill men. I know schizophrenia is a really serious disorder, but it is your responsibility if you have something that can harm people to take medication or else you are making a choice. I've got friends who have bipolar. They don't murder men. You know, I just, this, it's almost like it's an excuse or it's okay, everyone, don't worry. He was crazy. He had a disease. That doesn't keep us safe. As I said, a lot of people struggle with mental health and they don't kill people. I just think for us, it's just, I'm at the end of the tether with it, because you just, where are we safe as women? Where are your daughters safe? You both have daughters.
Well, my daughters.
Where's my daughter safe?
They went for a ride of their bike yesterday. We let them go because I think you just have to, you've got to trust the world.
How can you trust the world?
And, well, I mean, but we can't.
I know you can't live in fear and I know you can't stop doing, but I just don't think, it's hard for men to understand what it is like to not feel safe doing normal everyday things. And a shopping center, like how many other things do we have to add to this list? Girls' bathrooms. That young girl who got attacked in a bathroom, bathrooms aren't safe. Like, there is nowhere that we can go now where we feel safe.
The hero of this story is New South Wales Police Inspector Amy Scott, who stared down her own mortality and said, I'm going to do something. And she did something. Amy Scott is a hero.
She's incredible.
She's the hero that we all needed and we got. A woman who is in the police force has done an amazing thing.
Yeah, no, she's an incredible, and I'm sure, you know, it's one of many things she's had to do in her job that she would never have wanted to, but she's an incredible woman. But I think, the bigger picture is this is the biggest issue, one of the biggest issues we face in this country is violence against women, regardless of what the reason is or whether it was domestic violence, whether you're crazy, whether you're just a piece of shit. It doesn't matter. We need to stop it because what we're doing now is not working. It is not working.
Today FM. Joined now on the line by New South Wales Premier Chris Minns. Morning, Premier.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me on this morning.
We appreciate your time, mate. You've flown back from Japan after this horrible incident.
Yes. No, back in Sydney, it's a terrible, terrible event. And Sydney's in mourning. The Prime Minister's declared it a national day of mourning, which is really important. There's some families that have had their lives completely turned upside down. And whether you knew the individuals that were killed or not, I feel as if there's 8 million people in the state that have lost something, and it's going to take a while to get that back, but we're a strong community, we're incredibly resilient, and we will bounce back.
Premier, what does that mean, like a national day of mourning? You said that's important. Like, what does it actually mean for people?
Look, it's symbolic, largely, Erin, but symbols matter. And,
absolutely.
You know, lowering the flag to half mast, putting a black ribbon on the Opera House, which is what we're going to do this evening. Even if it's in the smallest way, for one of the family members that have lost someone, to say the community is behind us, I just hope that they can take a little bit of strength from that, because they'll need it. To hear the stories of some of the people that were killed, they had their lives in front of them. They were incredibly accomplished and credentialed young people. And I think that's added to the sense of loss. The rest of us feel that we don't know what these young people would have accomplished with the rest of their lives, but they just seem so fantastic.
It is so random. It is so terrible. There are heroes. I mean, we're talking about Amy Scott all morning, the police inspector who ran towards danger and neutralised the situation, mate. You must be so grateful to her.
I am. Living up to the best traditions of the New South Wales police force, I saw a media report yesterday where she said that she's not a hero, and to me that's exactly what a hero would say. I know there's a whole process where they have to award citations and bravery, but for me the verdict's in. What an incredible person. She was by herself. She ran towards the danger. She ensured that no one else was killed, and then she administered CPR. I mean, what an incredible person. A wonderful public servant. We owe her a huge debt of gratitude.
Yeah, she's one of many, isn't she, Premier? There's no silver lining, I don't think, to any of this, but the way that people rallied, that helped each other, everyday Australians putting themselves in harm's way, is something, as you know, Premier of this state, you can be proud of.
Well, it's cold comfort that there's a sense that there's some wonderful people out there, but few people have asked, what do you say to your kids when the images are so confronting and the circumstances are so devastating? And Aaron, I don't think you can lie to your kids. Kids are really instinctive and they're clever. The only thing you can do is put it in context. And the context I'd say to my kids are, yeah, there's some evil and wickedness in the world, but there's also some wonderful, wonderful people. And to see complete strangers put their own lives on the line to save someone that they've never met before is inspiring and an example of how good our community is.
Premier, just before you came on, I was speaking about the fact, and you know I'm very passionate about domestic violence and it's such a big issue, but now another safe space for women has gone essentially in our eyes. You know, we can't go to a car park at night. We can't go for a run at night. We can't go for a run early in the morning. We can't stay at home because that's where we get killed as well. Your job is to protect all of this state. How do we solve this pandemic of violence against women?
Well, I mean, it obviously is traumatic for women across the state, and to see such an ordinary thing that people would do on a typical Saturday afternoon, like go shopping with your family and friends or run an errand, to be turned upside down with horrifying violence is very threatening. We've got to do everything we can to ensure that we've got resourcing in place to keep the public safe. And there's no easy answers here. I want to make sure that these inquiries are comprehensive and that all of the options are on the table to keep someone safe from doing what is just such a typical and normal thing to do on a Saturday afternoon.
This is the Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
The Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
Joined now by the Prime Minister of Australia, the Member for Leichhardt, Anthony Albanese. Welcome back, Prime Minister.
Good to be with you, but sorry about the circumstances. Mm. It's a very difficult morning for all Australians, but I think particularly for people in Sydney.
Mate, where were you when you found out about the incident?
I was on my way travelling to Canberra, and the information was, of course, coming out. I was with, as I always am, with AFP personnel, and they received notification that there was an incident underway. At that stage, of course, it was unclear what was happening, how many perpetrators there were, and what the nature of the event was. I then received a full briefing from the AFP Commissioner Kershaw and spoke with the security agencies, including the ASIO Director General. And then I ended up doing a media statement with Commissioner Kershaw on Saturday evening from Parliament House. And it's an extraordinarily difficult time for people. I know that hearts are broken. I spoke with some of the relatives who've been directly affected by this tragic loss of life.
Prime Minister, how does it feel for you? Because, I mean, people who didn't know anyone personally feel physically ill at what happened. Do you feel a certain, I guess, as our Prime Minister, your job to keep us safe, do you feel a certain, a more deeper sense of tragedy and...
I don't think there's hierarchies here. I think everyone will feel tough today because what we all know, all of us have gone shopping on a Saturday afternoon. And if you live in Sydney, many people will have been to Westfield there at Bondi Junction. So the idea of this attack, we know that there would have been thousands of people there, and we can go through the just senselessness of this attack. I feel a responsibility to have a considered response, to be reassuring for the public on Saturday night, to ensure as well that at a time where there was a lot of misinformation flowing around, including on social media, but some in some mainstream media as well, to just find out as much information as possible and to then be transparent and inform the public of of that information so that I think the New South Wales Police in particular, but also our security agencies and the AFP did a remarkable job in a timely fashion of making it clear that there was one perpetrator, making it clear that this wasn't an ongoing event when the police inspector, Amy Scott, took out the perpetrator.
Can we just talk about her for a second, Prime Minister, Police Inspector Amy Scott, and the heroic act that she performed by running towards danger on her own? Have you reached out to her, or will you reach out to her personally?
What a hero she is. I haven't yesterday. I spoke with the New South Wales Police leadership yesterday when I was in Bondi Junction, and certainly passed on. But I look forward to having a conversation with her. She is a hero, as are some ordinary Australians who did extraordinary acts as well, ran towards danger and engaged in protecting their fellow Australians. So out of this tragedy, once again, we saw at the worst of times the best of the Australian character, that courage and bravery.
Yeah, that was something.
Was incredible. And this is just an awful, horrific incident. We will have flags flying at half-mast around the country today to pay tribute and honour the victims of this senseless act of violence.
Prime Minister, I know a lot of women feel the way I do today, and you look at, you know, where women can be safe and what's happening in this country and around the world. It's certainly not just here in Australia, but, you know, we can't run early in the morning. We can't run late at night. It's dangerous. You know, in our own homes, it's dangerous. Now shopping centres, which was a safe space for women, overall and bigger picture stuff, you know, it's a huge problem, violence against women.
It certainly is. And the gender breakdown here is concerning. And New South Wales Police have said that they're looking at that as part of the investigation here. Violence is always wrong, and violence at this scale is beyond comprehension, I think, for just about all of us. And that's why it will be really distressing. It is a time for us to mourn. Yesterday, I travelled back up to Sydney from Canberra before returning here to lay a floral tribute along there with Bondi Junction, at Bondi Junction. I have no doubt that those floral tributes will grow in coming days, because Australians will want to show their care and compassion. This isn't who we are. We are an inclusive society. We're one where we look after each other. And this act has shocked and horrified Australians.
The Husey, Ed and Erin podcast.
Bondi Junction, Erin. We've been gathering friends around us, actually, as a lot of people would be doing in Sydney. And one of our good friends is about to speak to us.
Yeah, he's an incredible man. Big fan of our show. Participates a lot. Former policeman and in quite a specific area, Ed.
Yeah, that's right. Former mental health intervention officer, Glenn Gorrick, welcome back.
Yeah, good morning, everyone.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
No worries, Glenn. Thanks for finding time for us. We know you were just on the Today show. Mate, this is your area. You worked in the police force for a long time.
Yeah, that's correct, Husey. I did quite a few decades in the cops, and was part of my retraining, I guess you could call it. They grabbed about 400 sergeants and then about another 1,000 constables and trained us all in what's called mental health intervention. And it was a wonderful changing of the way we did things in regards to mental health. You know, we had a relationship with the ambulance service where mental health patients were no longer treated as criminals. We treat them as patients, and we'd go as an intervention team and talk to them and then get them into an ambulance instead of a police car. And it worked. It worked wonderfully for a long time when I was in. I remember many incidents where we were able to negotiate our way out of it,
well, mate,
rather than take action.
I see this on the street all the time, where someone is obviously either on drugs or suffering from a severe psychotic episode, looks dangerous and they're around us and we're going to be seeing them, you know, probably more so from now because this incident will be fresh in our mind. So people are on the street who are, they are dangerous, aren't they? So how do you deal, what are you told, how do you deal with people in this situation?
Absolutely, Hughes. You couldn't have said it better. Mental health has changed. We've closed down all our institutions that we used to have over at Roselle, and we put it all back on the mental health wards in the hospitals, which are overrun, as you know, now with the bulk billing being cancelled.
Yep.
So people are being pushed out on the street. And what happens is they become destitute and homeless or helpless, and they actually go into a psychotic episode, but they don't know what they're doing. And they're not the person you know. They're a completely different I play on words, but animals, and they do bad things. And what happens is people need to contact the police. We're not going to lock them up or arrest them, but we need to engage them. And if you see someone out in the street that's acting strange, just ring your local station or ring 131-444 and just say, look, there's a guy or a girl. She's down here or he's down here. He's acting funny. But I think they need a bit of help. You might just save some lives, including that of the person with the mental health issue.
Yeah.
So we need to be very vigilant now and more so because, you know, in the days of technology now, we're looking down, not outwards. We're looking at our phones. We're not looking up.
It's a really good point.
People aren't calling.
Yeah.
Yep. That's a great point. Yep.
Glenn, looking at Amy Scott, what would have been going through her mind? Like when you're a copper, you know something's happening, you're running towards it, not knowing whether this person had a gun, a bomb or anything else. Like what she just did so well.
Incredible. Look, going through an incident where I had to shoot to save my own life, I can relate to it. And 34 years on, I'm still thinking about that particular incident.
Well, so can you tell us about that?
She's got a long road.
What you went through?
Yeah. You just, I was involved in a chase. I was on a motorbike and the crooks were done some robberies and they pulled up and decided to run me over. And then we had a shootout and my gun failed. I only got one shot away and they ran me over. So, you know, it was just a huge debacle back in 1990. And it still sits with me like it happened yesterday. And Amy is now, she will go through all that. There's a whole set of protocols and processes she'll have to follow. She's going to have to sit down and be interviewed, you know, when the dust settles. And even that will go on for quite some time. She's done absolutely nothing wrong. She's textbook training. We have what's called active armed offender training. I went through that where they put us all out at the old Amway factory and we were shot at with paint guns and everything thrown at us. And we had to go in as a team. And Amy, being the first on the scene, she is trained to go in. She has to run towards the gunshots. That's the active arm training now. And she just did it textbook. She has saved so many lives. I guarantee that.
Incredible.
I did a bit of a number on it where there was the 18 people over a few minutes. And she held back even 1 minute or 2 minutes, it's probably another 5, 6, maybe 10 people and so on. So her decision to go in has probably seen the fact that there's probably dozens of people walking around that have survived that.
Yeah, it's incredible. Injury. I think, how long it's did it incredible. Take for the other police to get there? And is that a normal amount of time?
No. My understanding, they were about 10 to 20 minutes away. The police at the moment are very under strength. They're battling shortage, as you know. And so they're so overworked at the moment, doing double shifts, recalls to duty. Mm. So they could have been at domestic violence jobs, which will tie them up all day anyway. And then they've got to pack up and get there.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we don't just drop out of the sky like we used to. It's just not the number of resources. And so she had a lot of time on her own there and she had to make some split-second decisions. And like I said, she's just gone way above and beyond. And considering the offender was what appears to be, anyway, allegedly chasing down women, and she's confronted him within what's called the 11-metre range. If someone has a knife and they're running at you, there's a good video on it. You can go on YouTube and watch its training video with the safe distance of knife. It's 11 metres. Even if you shoot the offender, they still will get
time.
To you and stab you.
Oh, my God.
So she did an incredible job. So can I just ask on that, her training, would have there been some sort of protocol that she should wait for backup, or did she make a captain's call going, I'm not going to wait for backup?
The training for the first responder at the scene, if you hear gunshots or you're told something's happening where lives are in danger, you go in.
Yeah.
It's changed. Yeah. It was the active arm training.
Yeah.
You go in and you call. She had a radio, so she would have called for backup immediately. And she would have known. We used to call it, we're waiting for the cavalry to arrive. You'd be on a job and you're on your own. I was a sergeant. I worked on my own on night shift for 15 years. So you call for the cavalry and you wait for it. Well, she would have been in the back of her mind when she put that call over, waiting for the cavalry to come, and then she had to take action. And, you know, she would have been waiting, and it would have seemed like an eternity for her as well.
So, yeah, well, incredible effort.
Former police officer Glenn Gorrick, a mental health team intervention officer, thank you very much for your insights this morning.
Husey, Ed and Erin are done for another show, but to pick them up after an early morning wake up, they're off to grab a regular cup of freshly ground coffee for just $2. Available 24/7 at 7-Eleven. Husey, Ed and Erin.